Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Jim and Austin. Today I thought we'd talk about Syria, different things going on there. One of the weirdest things that's going on, Austin, is this article in Vogue about Osama al-Assad.
Asma al-Assad, Bashir al-Assad's glamorous wife. Okay, that's really been run down pretty heavily in the blogs. But Dan, here's the thumbnail sketch. My column this past week, in the On Point section, says father son dictatorships still in vogue or something, making a pun off of Bug magazine. But yeah, I mean, you can still find this online, and I think it's actually the March issue, but understand it hit the web, I want to say, about somewhere between the 15th and 20th of February. So here was this piece, and it's glamorizing Osama al-Assad, and it even says in one point, I'm paraphrasing, but this is the gist of it, it's her job to put a new face or a fresh face on Syria's government. Yeah, right. One of the toughest of Middle Eastern dictatorships in the way that the Alawite minority, the religious minority that the Assads happen to be Alawites as well, treat the remaining roughly 85% of the country. 10% of the country is Alawite, and they've got another 5% that they've bought off along the way. So anyway, the article is there, and I refer to it in the On Point column. It's a bitter irony because right about the time it comes out, you start seeing the Syrian protest following in what we now call the Jasmine Revolution or the Arab Spring revolts. And I'm convinced, and this is my opinion only, that there was some sort of arrangement to take Asma al-Assad and feature her in Vogue magazine. And by the way, the article is just saccharine. I mean, it's just treacle for the wife of a dictator. It's you could imagine what Vogue would have said about Eva Braun, who I believe she was a model in Munich, wasn't she, Jim? I mean, Hitler.
She was a looker,
Yeah, she was. I mean, so
could have done something with her.
Sure. All right, but I mean, you know, you could imagine. I'm not going to make the mistake of equating the Assads even with Herr Adolf, but imagine something about 1934, or actually more appropriate would be early 1939, something on Eva Braun in Vogue and lauding about how her husband has re-energized Germany, you know, and something like that. That gives you, at least in my view.
Don't forget that modern public relations, you know, the sort of thinking that creates articles and, you know, glamorizing Eva Braun or, you know,
Osma Alice
Braun. Right. That was invented by Sigmund Freud's nephew. So that whole use of sexuality and, you know, the funny things that go on, you know, in our subconscious, is all of a piece, you know, and it's still with us, obviously.
Well,
when you have dictators, you know, putting their pretty wives forward as the, you know, the future, as it were. But ironically, there's something to that, because in all these countries, even the people who are on the outs have their upper crust, their operators. About two-thirds of the population in Syria is Sunni Arab, and there are some very wealthy Sunni Arabs who still back Assad because a lot of their wealth is tied up in favors from the Assad family. The problem is the majority of the population are not wealthy, but Assad, for example, he just recently gave citizenship to the quarter of a million Kurds, up in the northeast. And the Kurds have been agitating for that for years, and they hadn't gotten it for years because they weren't considered loyal. But basically Assad is telling them, look, guys, all us minorities, if the Sunnis, get in charge, just look around you. You know what Sunnis mean. He's basically circling the wagons. It was the same thing that the British used in Iraq. That didn't get overthrown until the 50s when the Sunni Arabs got together and just shot the royal family and told the majority Shia that, we're going to play by Sunni rules now. So there's all those animosities in that part of the world, and that primordial need to, get together with somebody you can depend on. And you can always depend upon, minorities. The British used the Christians, if they needed security people, they'd hire Christians. Potentates in the, emirs and what have you, royal families in throughout the Gulf states would love to hire Chechens. Chechens for centuries have been known to be, loyal and rough. If they're bought, they're state bought. They would fight to the death for you. And of course the Pope had his Swiss Guard. It's a matter of life and death even today in places like Syria, and we're seeing it playing out. But despite all that, the people at the top of the pyramid in each of these groups are willing to cut their own deals. I mean, they can make things up, with the less affluent folk and the less pretty folk. But they're all the same class. We see that being played out in Central America and Nicaragua, where the Sandinistas are now, we're basically from the same upper class families as the so-called right wingers. And they're just playing musical chairs with the government offices. Same thing in the Philippines, where each generation or each group of, reformers coming along, they're basically, they belong to the same country clubs as the people they're trying to, throw out of office. So this has to be kept in mind, that you're dealing with basically our crowd having, family disagreements.
Yeah, it's amazing. I've scanned over the article on her, Austin, and it is saccharine, and it's wonderful how she, as a Muslim, went and celebrated Christmas with some sort of Christian group inside Syria. I'm sure that's done all the time.
They are major. They are major supporters. You can always in the Middle East. You can always depend on the Christians,
right?
They've been facing them long odds for a long time.
Dan, that article really is an exercise in propaganda and information warfare, because look at the number of references in there it ends with talking about her going to Paris because she works for the Louvre. I think I used that in the column. I did.
The Syrians and Lebanese both like to suck up to the French because the French feel they are still the protectors of that part of the world used to hang out.
It's not just the only suck up in the article. The article's filled with emotional.
Embrace the suck.
Emotional blackmail. But look, let's get to the hard point of it. And I'm going to call attention to our readers to Jim's post today on Syria. Agitation in Syria is serious. Agitation really began in mid to late February. You've got numerous groups and with diverse goals. So you've got Kurds. There are a number of jailed Kurds who started a hunger strike as the agitation began. You've got Sunni militants from the Muslim Brotherhood. Think about Hama in 1982, where anywhere from 7 to 40,000, usually 20,000 is the number of slain by Assad's, that's Hafez al-Assad's security forces in what was a Sunni militant uprising. They're sitting on the Assad regime on a powder keg, and basically the thrust of my column, and Jim's made this point as well, it is like father, like son. Bashar's regime is a little bit smoother at running some of the propaganda campaign, but you're dealing with a structure that Hafez al-Assad put in place that has, it's similar to some things Saddam did, similar to Ceausescu, you know, and echoes of Kim Il-sung, Kim Jong-il's father. You're dealing with
a family business.
Oh, yeah. A brutal family business.
Yep.
And I mean, it's not so rare for a family to basically have their own country. Look at the Castro family. They did well. Ceausescu, they did well for a while. That's the problem. Most of them do well for a while, and then it all falls apart. Now, apparently what's going on in Syria is there are serious discussions with the reformers, shall we call them, feel that they could basically talk Assad and company into taking a large chunk of their money and getting out of Dodge, you know, going somewhere, leaving them alone. Because the main thing most Syrians can agree on is they want to get rid of the police state, because the police state and all the attendant corruption has ruined the economy. I mean, they watch the rest of the world in their neighbors, as it were, especially the hated Turks, you know, prospering because they've got more economic and other freedoms. And they just want a taste of that. And that's one thing literally everybody, I'm sure even members of Assad's own, you know, inner circle and family can agree on. But how do you break that chokehold the corruption has unless you basically get rid of the biggest thieves? And then, of course, you have the problem of, you know, stopping, you know, new big thieves from taking over. But that's Act Two. We're just approaching the end of Act One right now.
Well, I think the interesting thing about the article in Vogue was that they set her up as a counter to what is going on now in Syria, where she's supposed to be forward-looking and she's working with all these youth groups to, you know, move Syria forward into the future, et cetera, et cetera. So where is the agitation coming from, Jim and Austin?
All the people who've been screwed.
Yeah, oh yeah, it's agitation from numerous groups. I mentioned Kurds, okay? They're not the only ones. It's an entire, you know, you've got the Sunni agitation. You've got, even though some of the Christian groups are quote-unquote bought off by the Assads, it's still a dictatorship. You've got also a tech, maybe a better way to put this instead of a middle class, you've got an educated and technocratic class that has lived for at least two, three generations as being quote-unquote apolitical. And a lot of these folks will be living in Damascus. They'll be the professors, teachers, doctors, scientists, information technology people, and they know what's going on in the rest of the world to some degree because of their positions. They're quote unquote bought off by the Assads, but they really aren't. They don't want to live in a dictatorship. They know how things are better. Jim mentioned Turkey. Well, it's even better down in Jordan. And I will say some of my
not to mention hated Israel.
Oh, don't go with it. I wasn't going to get there, Jim, at first, but let's go there. I was going to say, well, let's just hook through Jordan to get to Israel. I'm basing this on not only conversations I've had over the years with the Syrians, but also with the Jordanians when, now this is about a 10-year-old conversation with, Jordanian business people. I'll put it that way, which is, yeah, there's so many Syrians that they do business with on a daily basis and flow through Jordan coming through Jordan and therefore international business. Unspoken there, this is my interpretation, was, oh, you mean you're ultimately doing conduit to the Israelis. I did not ask the guy that, but you got to follow the body language and, you know, as they say, follow the money. Well, who and doing business with everyone. And the way that this was expressed to me, this is actually a couple of conversations here, is that what they would like to see, the business class, and the technocracy, is, okay, go ahead and keep the regimes in place, but let us trade freely, please get out of the business sphere, and you will find that, there are reasons to cooperate throughout the, and this is another way, a term that they would use, instead of calling it the Middle East, refer to themselves as the Mediterranean Basin. Or the Near East. Now you get that, don't you? That's a, that was a decoupling from the situation then in Iraq and Iran. A decoupling, a verbal decoupling by Jordanian Arabs. I've also heard Turks use the same phrase. You know, the Mediterranean Basin, and it's really historically, if you look at it, a more accurate description of many of these connections. I mean, look at Libya. It's Cyrenaica and Tripolitania, to rip off the two old Roman provincial terms for what is now modern Libya. All right, to get back to the point, is that you have for a long term, and I said 2 to 3 generations, so we're talking about four decades at least, the business class, the information and technological class in Syria that chafes under the dictatorship, under military rule, under and the like, and you'll hear them, if you could get a BBC reporter into many of these places like Homs. As you could get a BBC reporter into Egypt and Tunisia, you would hear some of the same comments about jobs, information freedom, democracy, because you're talking to people who are educated and they know what they mean. You know, they know how democracy works. They can look at Turkey, you know, just to the north. That you're not hearing that. At least it coming out of the BBC or major news sources, you are hearing a little bit out of tweets and cell phones and some of the YouTube videos that have cropped up. But note, and I'd like to hear Jim's comments on this, note the Assad regime has been pretty effective, like the Iranians, on shutting down some of the alternative digital communication means, as well as
they've done it differently. They've done it selectively. They'll shut down an entire city, usually internet and cell phones, because the cell phones are a bigger problem. Everybody's texting, and for many people in outside the West, a smartphone or a semi-smartphone becomes their only access to the internet, to the web. So the government understands that, you know, if things really get desperate, you shut it down. Although that shuts down a lot of the security forces, especially the irregulars. You know, they have these militias, you know, Alawite, Christian, Druze, what have you. Basically, you know, young thugs who are willing to crack heads for the cause or for the government job they have. These guys are dependent upon their cell phones. So it's only in desperation do they shut that out, which they did a couple of days ago, I think, in Damascus. But it won't last long, because the only communications they have in the meantime are the police and military radios, which are not as abundant. Not everybody doesn't have one. You have to do a lot of shouting and what have you. But they will shut it down. But again, they can't do it for a long time because their own people are dependent upon these same resources. Indeed, that's what's happened to the web and to the cell phone technology, and it's become a major, you know, hassle for police states. That's why, like, North Korea just tried to stay away from it completely, but even they couldn't avoid it. You know, too many of their own people, not just the kids, you know, the children of the upper class, but they'll, you know, it's like Obama. He gets in the White House and says, look, I got a BlackBerry. Well, he's my BlackBerry. Make it happen. And even then, they gave him a hard time. But you can't fight that kind of, you know, technological progress. And in Syria, there is a fairly, as Austin pointed out, there are a lot of people who make themselves useful as university professors, technocrats, what have you. There is a bit of commerce going on there. And, of course, that's what Syrians are fighting for. They want more commerce. They want the kind of the amount of commerce they know they're capable of, and they're not getting it with a, you know, we're living in a police state. But there's enough of it there that there are lots of cell phones and internet connections around, and that's been, I think, in the long run will turn out to be one of the key factors in keeping this increasing unrest going.
Now, with them having such a firm control over the country, is there any chance for this to become successful?
Oh, yes. The problem is you've got about a third of the population are various minorities, which technically should support Assad, but they all don't. It's much like the situation in Yemen, where the Assads have put together this patchwork, you know, alliance of people who really it's in their economic and sometimes physical interest to stay alive, you know, to get bought and stayed bought. But the majority of the population is hostile, always has been, to the Assad, you know, minority government. So he's basically playing from a weak position, and he knows that. I mean, I'll give Assad credit. You know, he's not living in some imaginary land with his imaginary friends. He realizes that he's basically got to dance, you know, fast and talk his way out of this. Otherwise, he's done. I'm sure arrangements have already been made to get the family and himself, you know, to Paris or whatever, you know, if it comes down. And we're going to see it, you know, every Friday is the peak day in these countries because that's, you know, the Islamic Sunday. And that's when people love to riot. You know, you go to the mosque and then you go to the streets. It might be tomorrow. It might be this Friday. But it's not going to be too many more Fridays. Because each Friday the demonstrations get larger and more violent, and Assad knows if he tells his boys to go all Hamas, you know, go full tilt, you know, open fire, everything on it, with everything you got, there's no going back. Because if it's at the point, and it's beyond where it was in 1982, because then it was, you know, a fairly small segment of the Sunni population. Now you got everybody out there. Basically, if that flash of firepower doesn't send everybody scurrying and keep them, you know, down for long enough for the secret police to pick up the leaders, et cetera, it's all over. And the secret police, you know, and the military are going to realize it at the same time. So they're basically playing a game of chicken. And the Assad is playing with the weaker hand. It's all these things you don't read about in the media that are making a difference, the deals that are trying to be made, et cetera, that'll all come out, you know, eventually. But right now, it's what you can put on the streets. And thus far, the Syrian, you know, the population, especially the younger people and not so young people who are out there on the street, seem to be encouraged by what's been going on the last 6 weeks. And the government seems to be getting more demoralized. So the trend is not going in Assad's favor, but it could still turn around.
Well, they've got a lot of strengths. I mean, we've seen the same thing. Gaddafi has managed, not to move us to a discussion of Libya, but take a look at it. He really only had about 5,000 men in that regime maintenance brigade he had. But the fact that the rest of the Libyan military, such as it was largely untrained and was just kind of a way to distribute some cash around. The fact that he can bring in several hundred competent mercenaries from southern Africa and perhaps the Balkans, fight for him. He's put up a pretty stiff resistance given the few number of troops he's got and the huge space that Libya is. Now, I'm not trying to make a direct analogy between. The dictators are tough. They've got tough people fighting for them.
Yeah, but Syria has another big advantage, which doesn't get much talked about. Apparently, Iran and Hezbollah. Hezbollah is a subsidiary, wholly owned subsidiary of Iran. They are sending a lot of help. I mean, Iran doesn't want to lose a major, you know, satellite state, using a Cold War metaphor. And Hezbollah doesn't want to lose that supply line or escape, or, you know, that escape route. In extremis, you know, Assad might just become a creature of Iran, and they'll start calling the shots. Maybe they already are. Who knows? You know, it'll get curiouser and curiouser as we, you know, jump deeper into the looking glass.
Look, Syria gives Iran a port, an open port at Latakia on the Mediterranean, and, you know, those two Iranian warships, big supply ship, and the frigate that they sent into the Mediterranean headed for Syria. Remember that happened in late January, early February. But that is the conduit to Hezbollah. in Lebanon, the conduit, one of the conduits to Hamas in Gaza. But take a look at it from an Iranian state function as well. Syria puts the enemy, that puts Iran on the other side of Iraq, the traditional Iranian enemy, the Arabs of Mesopotamia. That's what Syria as a satellite or an ally does for the Iranian state. And man, they sure don't want to use that, because that's one of the ways that the Iranians have a deniability. So that we're not sending agents in there, even into Iraq. Of course they are, Iran-Iraq border. But, you know, these terrorists, they're not coming from here. No, they come up in Syria, sent them in through into northwestern Iraq across the Syrian border. That was called, we called it the rat line when I was on duty in Iraq. That was, and of course it was a rat, you know, here they come. And they come in and come down essentially the Euphrates corridor from Syria. Remember, the Euphrates River flows out of Turkey, cuts through Syria, and then down into Iraq. That's one reason, it's an aside to it, but it's kind of interesting. Syria and Iraq are still concerned about how Turkey's got ultimately all control of the Euphrates River flow, and they're about to work a deal on that, according to something I read recently in a Turkish newspaper. Assurance by Turkey that Syria and Iraq will get a fair share of the
Because that's going to be on hold until it dust settles in Syria. Something else you have to worry about in Syria is all those terrorist groups that have been hosted by Assad for decades. Not just the Iraqis we all know about who were working that rat line until some of them still are. But you've got those old, secular Palestinian groups from the 70s and 80s. Are still in business, alive and well in Damascus. And that's going to be interesting. I'm sure there are.
Jim, it's so complex. They've got Shia and Sunni, very violent factions that the Assad.
Oh, it's a terrorist supermarket.
No, sure it is. Yeah. And many of these groups, they don't like the Assad. I mean, they could turn on them in a heartbeat if they.
Yeah, but these groups have nowhere to go.
Oh, they go to Iran.
Somalia, Pakistan,
Iran.
Think of the options.
Oh, they go to Iran. They go to Iran. But that's, you're right.
Not the Sunni ones. The word's gotten out. If you don't mind being under house arrest for the next 5 years.
All right, well, if they're of use to the Iranians, they would. But this is where we'll agree on. Would you want to go to Somalia or North Korea? Or Iran, or would you rather be in Syria with its, nice coast there, or in Damascus, which is kind of a neat place? I admit that Venezuela is probably the best option for these guys, but with the exception of Venezuela and Syria, who the heck wants to go live in these places,
Now,
really crummy,
Is there...
Upscale terrorists want to live in nice places. They want to go to good restaurants, so...
Is there territory in Syria that Turkey claims, or there's any dispute over that?
Vice versa. There's a territory in Turkey that Syria claims, but very quietly.
But so Turkey has no interest in using this as an opportunity to.
No. If the Turks are getting mad at the Arabs say yes sir, yes sir. It's an old habit they haven't forgotten.
Well, I'll give you the quick rundown on that. It's. One of the names for it was the Sanjak of Alexandretta. That's where Antakya is, Antioch. Okay, but ancient Antioch. It's really Iskenderun is in Turkey. That's Alexandretta. But I'm trying to remember the other name. Actually, when it came up in the late 30s. It's one of the few territorial adjustments post Ataturk. Turks took control of that little slice where Antakya, Antioch, is located, and the Syrians claim that small place as actually Syrian territory taken by the Turks, and it's that. Is what Jim's referring to, I think, as a Syrian claim on Turkish territory. Isn't that right, Jim?
Yeah, they want it back. Yeah, okay. But it's not going to happen.
I guess I was wondering, Syria really didn't come into existence until after World War One, and I was just wondering if Turkey felt like they still had a claim to that.
Ataturk, the Turkish nationalists, right off, that's part of the deal coming out of when they overturned the Treaty of Sèvres and accept the Treaty of Lausanne, and the Turks had to do the population exchange from Ionia with Ionian Greeks and then Turks, still Muslims, still living in Greek territory. And Ataturk says it's over. Kemal Ataturk says the land deal is over. This is why that Sanjak of Alexandretta is the one that crops up. There's still claims that Armenia making claims on Turkish territory, and that's, of course, that's coming out of the east. But that's Sanjak. It is the Sanjak of Alexandretta that the Syrians claim. It was absorbed into Turkey. It's just a little thumbnail sliver of the coast south of Iskenderun, and the Turkish policy since 1923 has been, with that one little exception that I just described, has been, we don't have any claims on anybody else's territory.
Yeah, and there are over a dozen similar, situations like that in Europe itself. And basically everybody agrees to disagree. Nobody wants to go to war over, a part of a city or, some little bit of land on a border that nobody really cares about. Although in this case, the city is worth something, but the Syrians are lucky to be independent at all, because they were afraid they were going to get absorbed, by some other, larger entity, simply because it suited, Syria has been a part of some empire or another for thousands of years. It's been over 2,000 years since they've been independent. So this whole idea of independence is relatively new. And their real unrequited claim is for Lebanon. Because, historically, the Syria was what is now Syria proper and Lebanon. But Lebanon is basically a new creation. The Lebanon was always a part of Syria. But the French were behind making Lebanon independent because it was a way to have a Christian country, as it were, in the Middle East, or at least mostly Christian. But the Christians didn't keep up in the bedroom, and now they're about 40% of the population, 30%, whatever.
Let me give an additional wrinkle to that. It wasn't just on the Christians. The Druze were also an issue for the other Arabs. The Druze are considered to be heretics by the Sunnis, and there are a lot of Druze that live in the Lebanon.
Oh, yeah. Well, the Druze were the French between the Druze and the Christians, they'd always have a non-Muslim, country in the Middle East. But it hasn't worked out that way, especially since Iran got involved with all the ironies in that part of the world. Iran is backing the Shia minority and arming them to the teeth. But that's why Syria is the prize, because so many countries depend upon it either to keep the peace or to keep the mischief going.
Right.
Let me make one further comment, Dan. I know we're running up on time, but this is, look, talking about Lebanon being part of Syria, I had this description given to me by an Arab back in the 1980s about that I was going to school with, as what Syria is. Syria is a big Lebanon. And yes, this is, that's, I mean, because of the fragmentation of history, you'll also run into many, I have personally, Syrian Sunnis that have, they've got a view about their country that it's definitely not pan-Arab. They see themselves with Damascus and the like as being, over the long term, a center of civilization and learning. And this is also great. There's another reason that the dictatorship grates on this educated class and the technocratic there is because, you know, that's our ancient tradition. Why can't we connect with modernity on those terms? And they've got a legitimate, extremely legitimate point. Quick story. I was in Istanbul in 1992. I went shopping in the great Istanbul covered market, and I bought something from an Arab trader there, and I got to talking to him. He spoke excellent English, and he was Syrian. And he says to me, I know my family has been in business here. We can show that we were selling material from, you know, goods from Asia, Iran, or the like, here in Constantinople, in the 8th century A.D. So we're talking, you know, 1,200, 1,300 years on this. He says, there's a chance, but we don't know for sure, that it could even go back to the 5th or 4th century A.D. But he says, we've got family connections and records out of that because we were, you know, making, shipping through into Syria and then on ultimately up here to Istanbul. And we have a conversation. Let's say the guy's exaggerating. I don't think he's exaggerating by much. That's one of the part of the Syrian view of themselves as being, you know, traders, merchants, and with a grand history. And here in the late 20th century, early 21st century, you know, like you hear this, heard this out of Egyptians just 8 weeks ago. We feel like we're robbed of the opportunity to be an important player in around the globe because we've got a dictator sitting on top of us. Now, does that represent all of the dissenters within Syria? Of course not. But I'll tell you what, it does represent a significant number of the business and educated elites. So.
Well, and I guess the biggest danger in all of this in every one of these countries is not letting the power vacuum be filled by the radicals.
Yeah.
And sure. That's going to be the toughest thing for all of these groups to overcome, I believe.
One other thing. Where Syria, where it's located, you got Turkey sitting up there, and it isn't going to want another Iran on its border. That's my bet.
Right.
Yeah, that's when the Turks will speak up. Otherwise, yep. they'll stay on the down low and let things play out.
Watch that. And I thought I was going to ask Jim to comment on that, but that's my suspicion.
Right. Well, that's a good place to wrap it up, gentlemen, and we'll talk to you next time. Bye.
Till then. Bye-bye.